Mr. Hayward, Reel 8. Now, we got to the point when you moved from Farnham, All Saints, near Bury St Edmunds, up to Chippenham, near Newmarket, which in your notes is October 1942. So you'd been the other place a couple of months at most. Where were you? You were in a camp again?
Yes. In the case of Chippenham, the camp was built in the grounds of a country house, which was occupied by the officers. And our part of the camp consisted of Nissen huts. Those are those half-round corrugated iron buildings put on concrete bases. And they were equipped with the usual slow combustion stoves, but were very rarely lit due to the fuel shortage. That camp sticks out in my memory because it was infested with rats. These Nissen huts, they were built with a double skin. They had two layers of corrugated iron, and there was a gap between them, probably for insulation purposes. I think it was a terrible trouble. Now, the rats could live in that space, you see, between the two skins. And at first we didn't realise this until one night one fellow woke up in his bed, having left a barrel of chocolate under his pillow, and he woke up with an almighty scream, woke us all up, and switched his torch on and found there was a rat in his bed. Climbed up the post of the bed, and that wasn't very nice, so we learnt the lesson that you mustn't leave anything eatable in your bed.
Was there any anti-rat program?
No, the only anti-rat program I remember was when, for a sport, we used to sit on the mess room tables with our legs dangling, with a suitable brick or stone in our hands, and wait for the rats to pop up in the crevices between the paving stones in the mess room, and then we'd all let fly. But I do remember one occasion when I was on fatigue duty, loading up the mess room store with loaves of bread from a lorry, and we were throwing them hand to hand. And I caught one loaf which was so light compared with the others that when I examined it, I found there was a neat round hole bored in each end. And the rats had obviously gone inside and eaten all the soft bread and just left the crust. And so that sort of thing went on.
We talked a bit about guard duty before, and you've mentioned what time you preferred to go on guard, which was, I think, the middle night one. And you've said the reason for, but you also went on and then realised that it was from this time we've just come to, that it was quite a nervous business on guard. That's at Chippenham, isn't it? And in those areas, what was it like on guard duty late at night, or in the middle of the night?
Well, being winter time, of course, it was cold. This was, as we said in the notes, October 1942 onwards. We stayed there until probably late summer of the following year, and consequently, we had to go through the winter there at Chippenham, and guard duties were not very pleasant because you assembled at the guard room, which was positioned at a breach in the estate wall. The knockdown part of the wall, and put the guard room on one side with a sentry box there. You'd have to be very lucky to get sentry duty on the gate. I never got that, but basically, we were all marched about half a mile up the road into some woodland outside the camp altogether, and that's where the vehicles and tanks were kept because of camouflage. They were under the trees, and so of course if there was any bombing that took place, it wouldn't be on the camp, hopefully, because the vehicles were separate. So the tanks and vehicles were up in these woods. We were marched up there and then positioned singly at various points in the wood. we were put on duty, we couldn't hear the other sentries, they were at some distance away, so you were left entirely on your own, and on particularly dark nights, it was quite scary because you hadn't been used to being parked up in a wood in the middle of the night in the winter, and also you had this feeling that if there were any enemy,
parachutists
or anybody intent on damage, causing damage, commandos or German type commandos around, you were left entirely on your own, and you know, you couldn't really, you had to have your wits about you, so consequently looking around constantly, after a while in the darkness you begin to see even bushes start to move, and you'd be jolly glad when the end of your 2 hour shift came, and in the distance, especially on a frosty night, you could hear these boots marching up the road for quite a way before they arrived at the wood, and it was your turn to go off. So part of your time off was spent in marching back to the guard room. So that was experience of guard duty, not very pleasant.
Any other duties, or was it just routine duties?
Fatigue duties you got involved in.
What were they?
Largely fatigue duties consisted of sprucing up the camp, you know, tidying up any rubbish. That's my daughter. The whitewashing, the favourite army thing of whitewashing everything to make it look smart, and then there would be the usual cookhouse duties. That was a favourite.
What were they?
A favourite for the people in charge of the fatigues, not for us. But peeling spuds, peeling vegetables, washing vegetables, cleaning them up, cleaning out utensils, washing up after a meal. A lot of that to do. Fortunately, we didn't have to wash up things like crockery because we didn't have any. We just had our own mess tins, which we washed individually. Other sorts of fatigues. Just occasionally odd jobs. If something needed moving, they'd get a gang together and we'd have to manhandle stuff into a different position.
Anything else? How did you get on with the civilians at Chippenham? It's not that far away, but were they more friendly in Chippenham? Or Newmarket?
Chippenham itself wasn't a very large village. I don't think we saw the villagers very much, being on this estate outside the village. I don't even remember there being a church there, although there must have been one. Sometimes we went into Newmarket, but because it was a racy town, that seemed to be full of peculiar people, and so we didn't bother much with Newmarket. There was another little town in another direction called Soham, S-O-H-A-M, that was sort of near Ely, and that was fairly friendly until the Americans seemed to arrive on the scene, and then we got our noses put out of joint there because they had more money than us. So even that seemed to die out with me after a while, and after a while, I when the weather was nice, I would just go out for a walk and explore the countryside around, sometimes on my own, sometimes with anybody else that was available.
Had you made any particular pals? You've been with them 6 months, and you know, a fair while, and were you making any particular friends?
I was wondering whether you would ask me that. The fact is that we never seemed to have any pals for long. There was always seemed to be something. They didn't necessarily move away. They got posted away or something, or into another squadron. But things were always in a state of flux, so much that if you wanted to, say, go out for a walk, if you were free, you might might find great difficulty in finding the same person again. He might be on duty, or on fatigues, or he might be on leave. And consequently, you never really got to know anybody really well. Even the people that slept near you. You just went along with them on parades, and you know them by name. Some of them, of course, may not be the sort of person you want to be friendly with. You may not sort of hit it off with them. I don't mean to say that you were unfriendly in that sense, but they may not be on the same wavelength. I mean, when you have friends, you usually find somebody that has some common interest. And that wasn't always easy. So, but that didn't worry me in particularly, because I was in a unit where there were lots of people, so I didn't feel uncomfortable in that sense. And I've been used to, in civilian life, I've been used to going off on my own quite a lot, cycling, walking. Whenever I couldn't find a school pal that would go with me, I wouldn't get that worrying, I'd go off. If I wanted to do something, I'd do it and get on with it.
Now, one thing that happens, you got pneumonia, I think, while you were at...
Yes, I think that winter was particularly wet. We always seemed to be coming back from our duties wet through, and of course we wore those things called denims, which weren't very thick, and they soaked up the water quite well, so when we got back, we'd be literally wet through to our underclothes. And this happened so frequently that I suppose it had its effect on me, and I must have got a nasty chill at some stage, which was simmering away when I went home on leave and ready to break out. And that's when it happened. I'd hardly been home a day before this temperature came on, and was shuttled into hospital, a Canadian hospital, near my parents' home, which was on Lady Astor's estate at Cliverden, and they treated me very well there. I was amazed that with the aid of those new pills, they quietened down the pneumonia.
How bad were you?
As far as I recall, I got a temperature of 104 at Christmas time. I'd lost a lot of weight and was in a fairly weak and confused state of mind. I think I was probably almost delirious at one stage because I was shouting at them, I'd commanded to do something. And she eventually found that the civilian doctor wouldn't have anything to do with me, it had to be a military affair. And so they got on to the nearest military hospital, and Father took me there. And I was there, I think, roughly 5 weeks, which was amazing because the pneumonia side of things was under control within a few days. And before very long, I was allowed up and was given little jobs to do, like sweeping the ward floor and so on, back to army duties. But it was a very, very good hospital, very good atmosphere. And I was then allowed hospital blues and allowed out into the grounds to go strolls, which was very nice because it led down to the banks of the River Thames, a pleasant spot.
So, the unit was still at Chippenham where they went when you rejoined them?
Yes.
Or had they got up to Rudston?
Yes. The point about that leave was that it was officially classed as embarkation leave.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that, so we'll go on to that, because there are a couple of times, according to the history, that they were getting ready to be posted to overseas, active service, and then it was always cancelled.
Yes.
Were you aware of this within the unit, and was there a desire to go on active service, or is that... Or was actually you quite happy to be training in England and doing your bit in England? Do you see what I mean? How did you feel about the whole question?
Well, I think at that stage at Chippenham, everybody was getting bored with the continuous training, doing the same thing over and over again. And I think there was some rejoicing at the idea of going overseas, especially when they found it was the Middle East, where the campaign was going quite well for us at that time, and we thought, oh, well, that's a good point to go out there.
You knew it was the Middle East you were destined for?
Yes, we'd heard about that, and the tanks actually got on board ship at Liverpool, I gather, at that point. Not at the point where I was in hospital, later when I got back, this began to happen, and eventually I found myself...
Who took the tanks down then?
I would say that they went up by train on transporters. Yes. They wouldn't have driven that distance. They'd gone on transporters.
And did you share this general desire to get out to the Middle East and get in a winning campaign, but I mean to get into active
service? Yes, I think I was quite looking forward to doing something different. I think everybody was getting a bit tired of continuous training.
Were you nervous of the prospect of active service? Because even though you were at the time in the workshops, hit by bombing, all sorts of things can happen. Were you nervous yourself?
Probably only vaguely nervous, but I think they trained us up to the extent that everybody had got a certain amount of confidence that we were going to do the right thing and be on the winning side. We didn't really give our equipment much thought as to whether it was adequate for the job. We were just trained with that equipment and we were going to use it.
So how did it affect morale when it was cancelled?
Oh, I think we were quite despondent at the thought that we were going to stay in this rat-infested place called Chippenham. We didn't like it. When you heard the news that we were going up to Yorkshire later in the year, we were very happy to get shut off.
Was it more a desire to get away from Chippenham or a desire to go to the Middle East? Did you see, was Rudston as good?
Oh, yes. Well, that was a different...
It was just a desire to get away as well.
Just a desire to get away, yes. Certainly, we didn't mind the thought of going into action as a regiment. It was something, the idea was novel, new, and exciting.
Now, you also had an accident with a Bren gun magazine before you went to Rudston, I think. Do you recall that at all? What exactly happened, and what were you doing with a Bren gun?
Well, they had these classes. They were introducing us to the 100-round circular magazine, as distinct from that half-round magazine that you put on the top. It sort of went up in a sort of a quarter circle. Didn't contain as many rounds as the 100-round magazine. So they were introducing us to that.
So they train everybody, because you were in the... Mm-hmm. You weren't in the tanks, you were...
No.
Everyone got trained.
Yes, everybody got trained that was available. And so the only reason I can think that this accident occurred is that I must have missed a class somewhere along the line for some reason, possibly because I'd only just arrived back from hospital while these classes had started. So I joined in the class as was necessary, and I expect the sergeant in charge didn't give it a thought that there might be somebody there that hadn't had the full training. And so when he gave this command to, we'd all got one of these magazines in our hands, which was obviously wound up, you had to wind them up, but I hadn't gone through that part. And he said, release the safety catch. And I could see there was a catch on the top of this thing, but I wasn't aware that to release the safety catch, you had to get hold of the handle and grip it firmly to stop it unwinding, because I didn't know that was going to happen. And I was struggling with this safety catch and eventually got it released with great difficulty. But of course, immediately, because I wasn't holding this handle, it spun round. My fingers must have been close by, and this particular middle finger got the ball, all of it torn out. You can still see it. So
that's from your left hand, middle finger.
Yeah, slightly misshapen and flattened. But it did affect the nerves in that finger. There's not quite the same feeling in the ball of the finger as the others, even after all these years. But that was an accident through missing a lesson, as you might say. And of course, a grim way to learn how to handle a 100-round magazine for a brain gun.
Anything else about your time? Quite a dull, a miserable time from the sound of it in all at Chippenham.
Yes, we like at Catterick, we weren't very happy with the dinner meals there. The other meals were okay as at Catterick.
Were they particularly bad at Chippenham then? Because you haven't mentioned them in the last couple of, you know, Chailey or Farnham.
No, they followed the usual pattern of any old meat that they could get hold of and boil up. I mean, for instance, you never saw such things as chops. You know, you wouldn't have chops that involved frying them up individually, I suppose. And probably boiling meat was the best answer for a large crowd of people. And I suppose they had to do it that way. But the meat itself was so unappetising, and some of it revolting to look at, that most of us just pitched it straight into the pig bin, because the farmers had a well of a time at these camps picking up the pig bins. At least I hope that wasn't the cause of the BSE disease later on. It certainly went into use somewhere.
Would you complain about the food ever? I mean, because the officer's meant to come round and ask any complaints. I mean, did anybody ever complain? Or?
Oh, yes, I'm sure we heard people complaining, but some of it was so repetitive, the same old thing, the meat possibly, that we got used to the stock answers, that was all that was available. You know, you've got to put up with it. There's a war on, you know, that would be what they said, there's a war on. And we were reminded of it. And so I think after a while, nobody bothered, you know, they just put up with it.
Anything else about Chippenham?
Chippenham, yes, we had a memorable day or two in February of 1943, because one or two days were so warm that some of the chaps went swimming in the lake in the park. Yes, that was probably the reason why I remember going up for some nice walks. I explored several surrounding villages by going for walks, and was quite impressed with the countryside around there. I think that area is very nice. It's well worth a visit, East Anglia.
And then the next thing is the move down to Rudston, which is near Bridlington, which I think was October. No, June 1943, according to this. That's right. You said late summer, so
yes.
But whatever.
So it was early summer then, yes. So we got away after the Middle East scare, if you can put it that way, and got up to Yorkshire, and were very happy to do so. To get away from Chippenham itself as a camp.
Where were you at? What was your accommodation like at Rudston?
At Rudston, it was a mission hutted camp, so we went into mission huts again, but they weren't rat infested. I don't know why, but we didn't seem to have any trouble with rats there.
Was the food better?
The food wasn't bad, no. It was an improvement. And I remember there at Rudston, we used to go for our food supplies to a military depot at a place called Strensall near York. That's where, and I had the job on one or two occasions to take an empty truck over and get supplies. That was quite pleasant. Nice little run out.
Now, one thing there was that the Crusaders, you were quite right, your crews had been right, they were replaced with Shermans.
Yes.
Now, can you tell us a bit about the Sherman, describe it. I mean, obviously not the visual appearance, but just its characteristics as you saw it at the time, rather than, not with sort of later knowledge of actually fighting in. What was it like as a tank?
It was a very reliable tank, mechanically, and it had a certain amount of speed, in spite of its weight and very high appearance. It seemed to operate efficiently, and I didn't hear any complaints from the crews.
Was it well armoured and gunned compared to the Crusader, or...?
Well, it appeared, looking at it, to be very well armoured, but in retrospect, I'm not so sure that, although the armour was thick, it wasn't very tough armour. I got the impression that it was steel of a sort, but not case-hardened like British armour. It had been mass-produced and probably, moulded. A lot of it was moulded metal, particularly the turret, cast in a mould but not hardened. And I think that's why the Germans managed to penetrate them so easily, in spite of its thickness.
What about the gun? Was it 75mm?
Yes, they were equipped with 75mm.
What's that the equivalent of in the pounders? Because I'm afraid I don't know. I mean, because you'd had 6 pounders on the Crusade. Was it a bigger? That's a bigger gun, the 75mm, isn't it?
Yes, I think it was slightly larger in bore than a 6 pounder. I don't know what the bore in millimetres of a 6 pounder was, but probably slightly larger, very slightly. About the same length.
So still not a long range gun.
Not a long range, but very, very good when used for shelling, high explosive.
As an assistance to infantry rather than fighting other tanks?
Yes, occasionally useful in the case of fighting other tanks where you knew that the crew were perhaps unaware of your presence and that they were perhaps had their hatches open, and some of them may even be outside the tank, and therefore the high explosive was useful. They were shrapnel. Because I've never found out quite how they did it, but I gather that the gunner could do something to the shell so that it burst as an air burst rather than a ground burst. I'm not quite sure how they managed that. I've not been able to find out yet.
And what about the engine? Well, that was your responsibility, and you know, the inside, the actual workings of the tank. I mean, it was American, was it? Was it different, or was it very much standard? What strength engine was it?
I can't remember I've put it in the account, but I think they used Fords in some cases. I think it varied. I don't think every Sherman had the same engine in it, but they looked very efficient.
Were they as reliable as British engines, or perhaps the British tanks in their America?
Yes, no fault with the movement of the tank. Drivability, and the crews were very happy with it, because, as you know, I was myself in the Sherman at that stage.
So it didn't break down any more or less than the British tanks?
No, it didn't. No.
So the worst part of the mass-produced element was in the quality of the armour, as far as you're concerned?
Yes, that's right.
They had a reputation for catching fire. Were you aware of that at the time, when this is in Yorkshire, when you got them, or was this something you found out in action?
We weren't aware of the fact that they caught fire easily in Britain, but certainly once we'd had our first taste of battle in Normandy, we then became aware of it.
Were you suspicious of the location of the petrol tanks and ammunition and things? What caused it to catch fire? Did you have any sort of...
Probably not at the time. Only later was it realised that there was a vulnerability there.